Hey everyone, welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I am your host, Joe Stuber. Hope you had a stellar Star Trek day today. I know I did. That's right, the original series premiered 50 years ago. Of course, we've been celebrating 50 years of Star Trek all year right here on Comic Book Central. If you missed any of the Star Trek-themed episodes of Comic Book Central, of course, you can get them all by subscribing to the show on iTunes. They are in the archive section on the website, comicbookcentral.net. If you've liked the Facebook page, if you follow Comic Book Central on Twitter, you will see that I posted some Star Trek episode guide pictures on those sites. Every Trek-themed episode is listed there, so be sure to check those out, see if you missed any, and stay tuned. We are not done with Trek here on Comic Book Central. More Trek episodes are on the way in the months ahead, so stay tuned. Golden anniversary for Trek, silver anniversary for the show we're chatting about today on this special bonus episode of Comic Book Central. It is part three of my five-part Terrificon adventure. At Terrificon, I moderated a Q&A with the co-creator of the critically acclaimed, subversive, hilarious, and controversial cartoon, The Ren and Stimpy Show. Emmy-nominated artist-animator Bob Camp was at Terrificon. He was meeting and greeting the fans and celebrating the premiere of the show back on August 11th, 1991, 25 years of Ren and Stimpy. We're going to be talking about the series, the origins, Bob's former partner, John Crisfalusi, who originated the characters, John Kay, as you'll hear him referred to in the Q&A. A year into the show, John Kay was gone. Bob Camp and company continued the show for several more seasons, so it was a lot of history with the show, a lot of controversy. We're going to allude to some of that in the Q&A. A lot to get to. So, let's get to getting to it. Here is my Terrificon Q&A with Bob Camp. 25th anniversary of Ren and Stimpy, so we're going to be talking a lot about that. But really, just about your career in general. I'm going to talk about how you got into these things. Let's go all the way back to the beginning, like we did with Rick. What were some of your early influences? When did you sort of get interested in animation, all these different things, and realize that maybe this could be a gig?
I always liked animation. I always watched cartoons, you know, and it was just as much a part of my life is breathing or eating cereal. You know, it's like, right, and cereal and cartoons go together. But I never thought about working in the animation business. I just knew I wanted to draw for a living because it was kind of all I was good at and or all I could do. I don't know.
I'm pretty good. Was doodling as a kid? What were some of the characters you were drawing or drawn to?
Like, my earliest memories are just drawing. I'm just sitting and drawing out of my head, making stuff up. I was not an A student. I really wasn't. And I did not care. I just knew I was always going to draw for a living. And since my art teacher was insane and gave me F's because I didn't want to
be... In art?
Yeah, in college, yeah. Yeah, because she wanted to do, like, environment. And I wanted to draw Zap comics. You know, I wasn't interested in her baloney. So I just sat in the back of the class and drew. I don't know how the hell I passed high school.
Did you have some early influence? Because I know a lot of, I think back on like Looney Tunes and, some of those things. I mean, were you kind of just like focused on that and then not necessarily even the stories, but like how things looked?
Focus. What is that? I don't know.
You are.
I just watched Mad Magazine, number one. Mad Magazine. Harvey Kurtzman, Jack Davis, Mort Drucker, Will Elder. God love Will Elder.
I did like the early days of Mad.
The early days of Mad. I collected them. Looney Tunes, of course, cartoons. Like Tom and Jerry cartoons, like Hanna-Barbera, the stuff they did when they did make good cartoons, you know. Okay. And of course, even the TV stuff they did, a lot of influence there. I was never a big comics reader. I just didn't care about superheroes.
Okay.
Is it sacrilegious here?
Comic convention? Of course not.
Yeah, no. Screw that. No. Back then, it's funny, everybody who grew up in the 60s, we watched the same 11 TV shows, you know, and watched the same commercials. And it wasn't like now where there's infinite variety of input. You know, there was Have Gun Will Travel. There was The Rifleman.
Three channels.
You know, and there was The Munsters. You know, everybody had the same frame of reference. Now it's all shattered and crazy and nutty. But so, you know, I grew up watching Billy Mooney on TV, you know, and Lost in Space, that kind of stuff. So, and I think that as far as my cartooning goes, probably the biggest influence is the really great 40s Warner Brothers cartoons, you know, like Chuck Jones and Bob Clampett and Fritz Freleng and Frank Tashlin and all those guys. You know, I grew up looking at that. And so, back to how I got started. As soon as I turned 16, I got a job doing caricatures at Six Flags over Texas.
You're that guy.
I was that guy. I was a guy doing caricatures.
10 bucks and you drove me on a skateboard?
10 bucks, wow.
What did you get?
No, we got, for a side view caricature, I got $2.95 and I got a third of that. Not counting what I stole out of the till.
You can't even split that
for you.
Stole
a lot out of
the till. You can't even get a buck out of that.
You know what? Back then, gas was, you know, 32 cents a gallon.
Yeah, I know. Back in the day. I know.
You could run all week on $1 worth of gas. For a dollar, you could have a meal. You know, like life was good back then.
You probably got all the park food you could eat, too, right? Hot dogs.
Yeah, but that crap's nasty. Yeah, I go flirt with girls who sold the foot-long hot dogs. Who knows what those are made out of, right? Because they were cheaper than the regular hot dogs. And when at the end of the day, when they didn't sell them, they just like put them in a drawer or something. The next day, throw them back on the rack.
That's good eating.
Yeah,
that's good
eating. But Six Flags was great. Six Flags was how I learned how to create funny cartoon jokes quickly. And when whoever got a theme park caricature, anybody? Little running body running sideways, like with a cloud coming off the back of their foot, and a little sign saying Vegas, and they holding the bag of money, right? That stuff's tired. So I right away thought, well, that sucks. I don't want to do that. So everybody I did a caricature of, I would do an original idea and make it funny, like a panel cartoon.
So you're like chatting with them and trying to find out what their interests are and stuff.
Yeah,
like
I said, what do you like? What do you like to do? Oh, it's skydiving. Oh, yeah. And you got web toes? Really? Wow. You know, so I make jokes up about it and draw it. At my peak, and I guess I was around 18 years old, I could do a side view caricature in a minute or less and do them all day long. And I was doing them on an overhead projector, you know, with a Fresnel lens on it, you know, and shine, but really hot, really hot. You could get blisters on your hand if you weren't careful. And I was using India ink and a quill dip pen, like live ink, drippy ink, and doing quick drawings on animation cells that were in a little frame. So, you know, it'd show on the thing, and then you close it, and so it's got a little paper backing. And do those all day. So that's where I kind of learned to come up with funny gags and to draw funny pictures of people. I realized after a while that I remembered everybody I ever drew. Like I'd run into somebody at a mall, like in, you know, 10 years later, I go, wow, I drew you in 1972. You know, like, really? Oh yeah, you did. Yeah, that was my training ground for drawing funny. And then I travel around. I had a VW bus, and I lived in it with my dog. And I traveled around, followed the fair rodeo circuit, and I went to Provincetown, Massachusetts, went to Canada, went all around doing caricatures and portraits at rodeos, went to New Orleans, lived in New Orleans for a little while, dropped a lot of LSD.
Drugs.
Yeah. And, you know, just lived the life on the road.
And you did do some comic book work, though, didn't you?
Yeah.
Because I think there's one... I think there's something on your resume, though, that's near and dear to my heart, maybe near and dear to some in the audience as well. Did you ink were you one of the inkers on the Temple of Doom Marvel Comics adaptation?
Yeah, I worked on a lot of the movie adaptations.
Okay.
Well, anything that
has to do with the Indiana Jones podcast, too, so that's one of my characters I obsess over.
I worked on the Star Wars adaptations.
Were you inking on some of the...
I did pinups in them. And stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And a lot of times they would come up, any movie that had Harrison Ford in it, they would ask me to fix the faces, because Harrison Ford's got a really messed up head. You ever look at his face? It's like nose is over here and his jaw's over here. And another thing I realized is that him, back in those days, him and Steve Martin looked exactly alike. exactly alike, like twins. And I tell people, and they look at me like I'm nuts. But they had me fix all the Harrison Ford heads because I could make it look like
I did interview one of the artists that worked on that, especially the Indiana Jones comic book, and they said Harrison Ford was the toughest to draw because it's just that.
They try to fix his face and make him handsome and symmetrical.
Yeah.
But he's not handsome or symmetrical.
He's a regular dude, yeah. He's another guy.
Yeah.
They always lose the hat. They always wonder why they lose the hat in the Indiana Jones comic. They said, a lot of the artists said it was the toughest thing to draw, too.
Get rid of the hat.
He comes into one of the panels, and then like later on in the comic, he'd get it.
Hats and shoes are hard to draw. I went to the Mad Magazine School of drawing hats and shoes, Jack Davis shoes specifically.
All right, so getting into some of the animation stuff, was the real Ghostbusters, was that one of your first
cartoons? Yeah, no. The first cartoon I worked on was a little thing called Thundercats.
I think we may have heard of that.
Back in the 30s. Yeah, I worked on that. I did character designs and at Rankin Bass, which was a pretty cool studio. It was very small. Most everything was done in Japan by Japanese people. And but I did character designs and design backgrounds, props, design kind of a whole lot of stuff on Thundercats, Silverhawks, and Tiger Sharks, which was a really great but short run show. And also some other shows I did. Mini Monsters, Karate Cat, and Street Frogs. Street Frogs was kind of cool. Anybody who's like a big hip-hop fan, it was the very first time anybody ever did a cartoon characters of hip-hop characters. Or a cartoon about hip-hop. It was way ahead of its time. Anybody hip-hop fans here? Anybody? You're a hip-hop fan? You ever hear an album called Renegades of Funk, Africa Bambaataa Suicide Force? I did that cover. Okay, me. Nucleus, Wiki. I did two of their covers, the ones with the spaceships and the dinosaurs and stuff. I did that.
That's digging deep on the resume.
Yeah, well, I have fans from comics, I have fans from animation, I have fans from back when I did those covers.
Is there a medium you enjoy working in more over the others, or is it just the...
Putty. I like doing things with putty.
With putty?
No.
You have like a big silly putty? Get some Play-Doh downstairs that we can...
You know what? Kind of back to what we were talking about a minute ago about like getting into animation thinking is what I wanted to do. I never had a preconceived notion of what I wanted to do or like my future or like, yes, tomorrow. Because I'm screwed up in the head. So I live in the moment. 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 Who are you? You know, so I'm not thinking about tomorrow or what I need to do, which is... maybe good, but probably bad.
Great for deadlines. I would think that would probably be.
You know, see, and that's another problem, too, is that, you know, on Ren and Stimpy, John Kay didn't care about deadlines.
No, he did not.
So he did not encourage making deadlines. That's another story. But, so, yeah, I worked at Marvel through 88, and starting in 85, I was also working for Rankin Bass doing animation. I was doing both.
Okay.
And then, anybody, comic fans here? Any comic fans?
There are a few.
The last thing I did for Marvel was, I was inking you could probably figure this out in 2 seconds on Google. It was an Iron Man What If in 88 that was penciled by Steve Ditko. And I got 4 pages in and I had a panic attack because I realized I was fixing all his drawings. And I was like repairing his stuff and I was making, like fixing his...
That's gotta be brutal.
And I thought, oh shit, I'm fixing Ditko.
Yeah.
You know, and I just said, I can't do this anymore and I went to California.
Because Ditko's 60s, different than Ditko probably 80s.
Oh yeah, yeah, and you know...
He's a legend. I mean, that's... Yeah, yeah.
So, and I was kind of, didn't want to do comics anymore because... and it's stupid because I quit comics like 15 minutes before people really started making money in comics when they were getting, like, you know, getting residuals and money back because I never got that.
Creator-owned projects.
Or just anything, you know, even getting a decent salary. Yeah. So then I moved out to L.A. I got a job on Alf Tales. I worked on that for 2 days. I hated it. And then I got a job on The Real Ghostbusters sitting to a young man named Bruce Timm. You may have heard of him. And we did all the ghost designs for Ghostbusters, which was really fun. And Bruce I call them the human sewing machine. Watching his hand move, it would just blur. Just like drawing, you know, and just creating masterpieces really quickly. And chain smoking cigarettes and stuff.
He was doing for animation what you were doing for characters back at Six Flags.
Yeah, I guess. But anyway, so I'm sitting next to him, and one thing that Bruce and I have in common, and probably him to a greater degree than me, is we're sponges. Like, I could walk around here and look at everything in the room and remember it and draw it later. I could look at people's drawings and pick up their style and go, okay, I see what he's doing, and then own it, you know. Robin Williams did that with jokes. No one wanted to follow or go on stage before Robin Williams because he'd steal all the jokes. He wouldn't try to, but he'd just do it. So I learned a lot watching Bruce work and working with him. That was great. What did I do after that? Worked on Tiny Toons. Worked on a lot of movies. Of course, we did Ren and Stimpy.
I was going to say, it wasn't long before you got into the show that we're celebrating today, 25th anniversary. On what are the boys up to? Have you talked to them recently? What are they, what's going on?
They're both dead. We got doppelgangers working, people that look like them. They're okay. I'm doing them. You know, I got a beef. I like Nickelodeon, and a lot of people like to bash Nickelodeon. My ex-partners at the head of that list, you know, over the years I've grown to be pretty grateful for them giving us a chance to do the show and for putting up with us, because we really were, and I was like number two, so they put up with a lot, and I'm just grateful for that. But
how did you get involved in the world of Ren and Stimpy? Because this is this kind of goes back with John Kay the genesis goes back with him. When did you sort of meet up with him, and how did you get involved?
Well, I was kind of at that anyway. So I'm working on Real Ghostbusters for Will Mineo, in fact, and Michael Gross, who's the producer of the movie, and who was the art director for National Lampoon. He just passed away last year. Down the hall, they were making the new Adventures of Beanie and Cecil. John was directing that, and most of the crew were people who had worked on Bakshi's Mighty Mouse with John. So they were a bunch of crazy SOBs, and they did not give a shit about anything. And it was their mission in life to see how much they could get away with, and to buck the system, and to be funny a-holes, you know. So I thought, wow, those guys are fun. I'm going to go work with them. So I went down the hall, started working on Beanie and Cecil. And it probably took maybe 2, maybe 3 months for John to get us all fired on that gig.
It took that long, did it?
Yeah, well, you know, we had momentum. But I worked on that a little bit. And I was that was the first show I ever did storyboards on. And I realized pretty quickly that, yeah, this is something I can do. He got us all fired. They came in and just yelled at us, "Get out!"
Was there an event? I mean, like, did something? I was just sort of building, and they just got tired of the crazy.
You know what? It was first of all, Eddie Fitzgerald was directing one of the units, and the most devoted friend of John Kay, and so John fired him, and so there was a crew of people doing layouts and storyboards on cartoons with absolutely no supervision. And John wouldn't talk to anybody, he was hiding in his office. So we were in the screening room, and Jimmy Trias, who was the producer from ABC, I believe, was in there. We were screening some footage that had come back from the animators overseas. And you know how in Beanie and Cecil, at the end of every cartoon, Cecil would sing, "Cartoon." Well, he's singing that bit, and he's standing there in the water, and while he's singing it, a washtub floats up, and Beanie's sitting in it, smiling, and then when Cecil quits singing the song, he reaches down and snorts Beanie up his nose, and then goes, and spits out his clothes, and Beanie's gone. And the woman who's sitting in front of us looking at the screen just screamed, "Ah!" and our arms went up. And John and I almost knocked each other out trying to get out the door. And we ran down the hall and locked ourselves in his office and hid like children. Yeah, we did that a lot. Because we weren't, you know. It's not like they gave us a cartoon to do because we were responsible adults or because we had run the run animation studios before.
But didn't that rebellious nature and those rebellious acts, but didn't that sort of lead to the tone of Ren and Stimpy? And
it was it was central to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what set it apart from other things. I think if it had been a standard cartoon, it probably wouldn't have taken off the way that
they
it did.
They tried to get us to make it a standard cartoon right off the bat, and there was a guy who was a head writer at the very beginning for Nickelodeon, and we were in meetings with him, and he said, well, we think you should put Ren and Stimpy be like a regular pet, dog and cat, in a home, so that, you know, they're there with the same people. It's like a sitcom. And I go, what are you, an idiot? You know, up to a network guy in a meeting. So, I
think you still got the gig.
Well, I don't know how. But, I said, look, you know, he said, well, I think it'll give you a lot of opportunities for the writing, you know. What, you think I'm five? You know, I'm not, no.
And in all fairness, too, going back at that time, you mentioned Nickelodeon. It was a kid's network, and that's why I was kind of looking at it.
It was? Oh, man, I feel terrible now.
But all these years later, you should feel terrible for what you've done.
Jeez.
But you think about it,
I gotta go.
You think about it, too, maybe that wasn't the home for it. Because you said, you know, it was great that they put up with a lot. But in all, you know, that guy was probably...
Nickelodeon, like I said, they were great. They put up with a lot from us, you know. And there was a point, there's a point where they finally couldn't take it anymore and they fired him.
It was so different than anything that was on.
Yeah, but we were making it for us. We weren't making it for anybody else. We weren't really interested in our audience. Because there was, you know, one thing that drives me crazy about the animation business is you go pitch a show to a network executive person who's taking pitches, and then they have their marching orders, you know, and say, well, we're taking pitches for our children from 6 to 11 years old. And I go, what does that mean? 6 to 11. I know a 7-year-old who writes epic poetry, and I know 22-year-olds who can't do subtraction. You know, I mean, it's like you can't
talk down to
you can't talk down to kids, and you can't figure out your audience this way, because the greatest things that have entertained us through since entertainment has begun has been stuff for everybody. And as soon as you start, you know, making this little hole to push your entertainment through, you get shit out the other end. You get stuff that nobody wants to watch. I mean, my theory about children's entertainment is that it's dog food. You watch your dog eat it. If the dog eats it, then you're satisfied. If the dog doesn't eat it, you get dog food that they'll eat until they eat it. It doesn't matter if it tastes good or if it gives them diarrhea. We don't care. We just want the dog to eat it. Well, that's what children's programming is.
We're talking a whole new way now.
You know.
But going back to the Looney Tunes and the Warner, isn't that what the creators of those cartoons kind of did? They were doing them for themselves.
They were doing first of all, those guys were nuts. They were nuts, and they had all the lunatics were in charge, just like with us.
Yeah.
And they were doing theatrical shorts. They worked when TV didn't exist.
Right.
TV was something you read in, you know, science fiction. Yeah. And so, you know, and those guys, those cartoons were meant to be shown like for a week and then go in the trash. No one ever thought that you'd look at those films again, or that they'd have a history, or that people would watch them in the next 70 years. No one thought about that. So it was just like something funny to show after the Bogart movie, and that was that. You know, and so it didn't matter. It's like...
Yeah, they weren't designed for kids in mind, as I was saying. They were putting their own jokes in, things that made them laugh.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing about it is, it's like people, you know, I remember my parents in their age, you know, they grew up like before the war, and they were in like the World War II era. It was like normal to go out on weekends and get drunk and get in big fist fights and get the shit beat out of you, and the cops not have anything to do with it. People didn't live in this world of litigious nonsense where you're afraid of lawyers looking over your shoulder all the time. It was kind of more of a real world. So people weren't worried so much about, you know, what people watched or did, you know, and you know, they were No, they kind of were too, because then you had the Comics Code, which came along, you know, in the McCarthy era and all that. But I don't know. I think we're overly concerned with what kids watch, you know, in entertainment in general. So I figured it was my job to push the cartoons as much as I could push them. It was Nickelodeon's job to push back. I wasn't trying to second guess what they would or wouldn't take. I tell the story a lot. It's one of my favorite stories. Anybody ever seen a cartoon we made called Prehistoric Stimpy? It's one of the great ones. It's a really funny one, right? And you'll agree with me, there's a lot of innuendo in that one. There's a lot of stuff in that one. It's dense with objectionable stuff. So, which I'm pretty proud of. But the broadcast standards and practices people give us the weirdest notes. Like they said, please remove the marijuana trees from the background. I'm like, those are ferns. You know? And people go, no, tell them they caught you. Yeah, you're really smart. Thanks for pointing that out. We'll try to watch it in the future. My favorite story from that cartoon is Wilbur Cobb. One of my favorite characters is voiced by the great Jack Carter, who passed away last year. And he's telling Ren and Stimpy why the dinosaurs died. And they think he's a tour guide, but he's actually a lonely bone polisher, right? So he tells them, well, I'll tell you what killed the dinosaurs. They ran with scissors. No, they swam an hour after they ate. No, I'll tell you what killed the dinosaurs. It was a jockage. Really bad jockage. Well, the network said, no, you can't say jockage. And I'm like, why? There's Crew X ads on TV all day.
The commercial probably after.
Yeah. And they said, you can't say jockage. I said, okay, I'll think of something. I'll call you back. So I'm thinking, I'll call back. Okay. Can we say hemorrhoids? And they said, oh, yeah, you can say that. I'm like, I lost my mind, right? So I called Jack Carter up. God love Jack Carter. Jack Carter shows up. I said, Jack, this may be the high point of your career. You know, I'm just happy to be here to share it with you. So, Jack.
When would he have ever relooped dialogue?
Jack's line was, I'll tell you what killed the dinosaurs. It was hemorrhoids. Really bad hemorrhoids. You know, and we caught away with it. I don't know how. It may have since been cut out. You know, who knows what they've done to those cartoons? But I
amazing stuff. Well, it was amazing. It was an amazing series too. I'm sure we've got a lot of Ren and Stimpy questions out here. Why don't we throw out to the audience? Who's got a question?
How did Powdered Toast Man originate?
Powdered Toast Man is the question.
Powdered Toast Man
origin.
Powdered Toast Man. You know when you leave like the wax paper thing not closed so good and your cereal gets really stale and kind of yucky? It has nothing to do with that.
That's maybe hungry, though.
John made him up. I have no idea where he comes from. It's like cereal's just funny because it's like what we all lived on. It's what I grew up. It's all I ever ate, you know? So, you know, you're going to come up with jokes about cereal. And so, like, he just makes different, like, so Powdered Toast was one of his ideas for a cereal called Powdered Toast. And, of course, he had to come up with a guy to put on the box, and why not Powdered Toast Man?
Makes sense to
me. You know, so much of the stuff in the show really has no, it's just nonsense. It doesn't really mean anything. Yeah.
I got another question. At one point, and I just saw this proposed in a magazine. I don't know if they incorporated Ren and Stimpy, but they had, like, these overly muscled superheroes, and they had this one guy who looked like Kirk Douglas because they all had a dip.
Was it? Another animated show?
No, I think they were introduced, I think, in Ren and Stimpy, but they were by the same animators.
You're talking about Ripping Friends.
Yeah.
Ripping Friends. That was a show concept John had that before Ren and Stimpy. That had been around for years, and he kept trying to pitch it, and then it got made. I have actually never even seen it.
As a director, I mean, we know film directors. What they do as an animation director, can you kind of walk us through what you do? How well do animated characters take direction?
They don't. They're stupid, first of all.
And or are they better to work with?
And they're only 2D, so there's limitations. Animation directors make films one frame at a time, and live action directors shoot a lot of coverage and let their editors cut it. I mean, they're all different, but animation's harder. It's you know, every frame has to be created and crafted, and there's layers and layers of stuff, and there's a lot more involved. And as far as actual directing, you direct the voice actors. Now, it's kind of changed since the Ren and Stimpy days. When we did Ren and Stimpy, if I'm directing a show, I direct everything. I'm the creative voice of every aspect of production, from writing.
You're storyboarding it off the front too?
Sometimes, but no, we had storyboard artists, because you're making a bunch of cartoons. You can't do everything. You know, and if you try to, it'll just kill you. But I would supervise. I would like direct the actors. I would work with the background painters, with the layout artists, with the animation studio. Supervise all the post-production, the sound recording, the music, all that. Now it's kind of broken up. I think at Nickelodeon now you have people who just direct the voices. They direct the voices on all the shows.
We've seen like Andre Romano for the WB stuff and just working with the actors.
You know, and I love them for what they do, but I'm not interested in that because, like, I'm going to make a cartoon and just hand it off to somebody else who doesn't really know anything about the cartoon, and they just have this fun relationship with the actors, and they go in there and they, oh, hi, how are you? Oh, let's do this thing. Ooh, you know, and they're goofy and fun.
Yeah.
But everything's exactly the same. All the characters are the same, the voices are the same, the same, the same, the same. So any vision that's in the show from the beginning as a creator gets washed out, you know, and it just becomes the same kind of crap that they're doing on the other shows, which is okay if that's what you want to do. But there are storyboard directors, there's animation directors, so it's kind of broken up. And it depends on the studio, too. Some studios still have, like the director, has a lot of creative control, you know. I think maybe at Cartoon Network that's the way it is, but I'm not sure.
Are you a control freak by nature? I know with being a producer, that's kind of like part of the job description. That comes with it.
No, I'm really not a control freak at all. I'm barely functional.
Okay. Because I am a control freak. That's why I asked.
No, I'm
going through.
My big problem is I don't know when not to say stuff. Like, well, that's the worst idea I ever heard, boss. You know?
No filter.
Wow, you suck. No, I don't say that, but I'm not a real control freak, but I can't not do the best I can do, because I don't, the concept of that just doesn't make any sense to me, which sometimes works against me. I don't know.
It's like I said, as a producer director, you almost have to, especially if it's something that.
Yeah, I like to let people do what they do and you know, trust them. When I first started directing cartoons, John, my ex-partner, is a control freak to the point of like wanting to kill him. In fact, this
just
is
just you or most people.
No, there was a. In my office at Spumco, there was a hole in the wall with a sign above it that said John's knees. And when people would get mad at him, they would come in and say, can I kick John's knees? And they would kick the wall as hard as they could. And pretty soon it was just a huge mess and the broken sheetrock and everything.
All those behind the scenes.
I can't believe I never took a picture of it. But no, I'm not a control freak. I tried that at first, and I realized that I wasn't getting any sleep, and I was miserable.
It's a lot of work.
No. So I, as far as artists go, you got to get in their head, and you got to let them learn by their own mistakes. Try to guide them and help them. I'm pretty good at the creative part, and I've got a good eye and all that. But I'm not about control. Should we do questions?
Let's stay down. Yeah. Got another question.
Anybody
other
questions?
Over here on the left.
Yeah.
On the one of my favorite episodes is when I think it's Ren had the bad tooth. That's good.
Ren's toothache.
Yeah. And the way it went into like ultra realism when you're pulling the tooth out.
It's close. Yeah, I call it those paintings. I call those gross ups. I did those on the pilot. In the pilot, there's a whole section at the beginning. It's kind of a montage, and it's just one gross up after another, close ups with pores and. and close-up eye.
So these, like, fully painted...
Fully painted. The theory behind that is that when you got to do something gross, you do it close-up, and you do it as a painting, and you put as much love into it as you can muster. But about that cartoon, you know, the network did not want to do that cartoon. I wrote that cartoon. They didn't want to do it because they said it was too gross. And I said, I promise you kids will brush more. And I was lying through my teeth, but it turns out it's true, and I've had thousands of people come up and tell me, oh my God, you frightened me so much, I thought the toothpaste was going to come get my nerve endings. So I started brushing like crazy. I'd get up in the middle of the night and brush. And I talked to dentists, and they say, yeah, you traumatized a lot of kids with that part. So I figure, you know, I've got dentists thanking me. I've got mental health professionals thanking me. You know,
there's your education value, right? That was for kids. A kids network. Now you're teaching kids. So
I am a teacher. I teach at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. I teach animation storyboards.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, but not the gross up stuff. You're doing a little.
No, I don't. I teach them how to tell a story with pictures. You know? Okay.
Well, and this, I think Ren and Stimpy was almost a storyboard-driven show, too.
It absolutely was a storyboard-driven show. The storyboard artists had a lot of freedom to change dialogue, to create. And, you know, so many shows are script-driven, and, you know, the writer is the final word. And you, I'm sorry, you can't change that, you know, because it's written down. It's like, you know, where's the writer? I'm going to break his nose because he sucks. And he can't write, and he doesn't know, and he's writing tired old crap, and I don't need him. I'm a better writer than he is. You know, we ended up hiring writers on Ren and Stimpy just because of the volume of work was too much, but we hired guys who were funny and could actually draw, you know. Just thinking you can write cartoons because you like cartoons or you want to write cartoons doesn't mean you can write cartoons. It's a very different thing, you know. It's like, you know, when Laurel and Hardy made movies and they had a script and there was a bunch of funny business going to happen where they're going to take apart a car with their bare hands or something, it would just say business because it was up to them to choreograph it and work it out. Some writer at a typewriter saying, then he punches him in the nose, then he goes, ow. You know, you can't write that kind of stuff.
Abbott Costello, famous for that. I mean, they use the script as just a starting point and then would just change things. And who's going to argue with Abbott Costello at the time, either? So.
Yeah, those guys were really funny. Yeah. And Lou Costello owes everything to Fatty Arbuckle. If you guys don't know Fatty Arbuckle, look him up. He was sort of like Buster Keaton was his protege. If you love silent comedy, check out Fatty.
And now we've transitioned into silent film era. Right, you know, we did that.
And check out silent comedies because they're wonderful. And, you know, Clampett and Jones and all those guys were inspired by silent comedies. That's where they got their comedy chops.
And we can certainly see that. Any other questions? A lot of things you did. Yeah, push right here in the middle.
Hi. Did you ever have any small, like, side characters you drew in Ren and Stimpy that were really kind of dear to you? And you're like, I'm going to try to get him in everything I can.
Like a character in the side characters in the show?
Yeah,
all the time.
Who's one of your favorites?
Wilbur Cobb is one of my favorites. Who else? I don't know. I love Stimpy. Stimpy's just—he's the most endearing character ever created because he's just full of selfless love. He donated all his butt fat so Ren could have pectoral implants. I mean, that's real love. You know?
Deep friendship right there. Another question?
I like the chicken. You know, the headless chicken, the one that's in the ice box when they're making the prank calls and where Stimpy falls in love with the chicken and I love chicken. And not only is he cheating on Ren, but he fits Ren's dinner. I love that. Anybody else?
Right over here?
Yeah.
What was the biggest thing you were able to get away with in Ren and Stimpy?
Question was the biggest thing you got away with in Ren and Stimpy?
It was a lot of stuff. There's a funny one where Stimpy... It's the name of the cartoon, I can't remember. Stimpy realizes he's used up 8 of his 9 lives, and so he's only got 1 life left. So he's always careless before and always like not really worried about getting hurt because he's a cartoon character. But he realizes he's only got 1 life to live. So he becomes really paranoid about dying, so everything's scaring the hell out of him. And there's a scene in it where he walks into the bathroom, and Ren's sitting on the toilet taking a crap and eating a sandwich. And Stimpy's like, oh my God, Ren! You can't do that! The germs! Ah! And he runs into the corner and he imagines germs like spilling over the bowl and cornering him and eating him alive. Well, the network said you can't have Ren sitting on the toilet eating a sandwich. So we changed it to Ren sitting on the trash can in the kitchen taking a crap and eating a sandwich. And that was okay. So, you know, that was the craft of what we did. Just no one looked what to change. We just tried to keep it weird. We did get away with a lot, though.
We hear this all the time from creators, too, that sometimes they'll put extra things in.
Red herrings.
Knowing the network.
We put in jokes specifically for them to cut out, and they would ignore those and take out a lot of things over and over again.
They were on to you.
The boil, the pus, you're supposed to take that out, you know. It was always weird. Like, one week we could say the word crap, so we say it 10,000 times, and then suddenly we couldn't say crap anymore. It's called broadcast standards and practices. I call it double standards and practices.
Just change from, well, probably change with whoever got the job that week. Maybe the guy got fired and the other one didn't like it.
I don't know. I just felt like that the network people just didn't get us at all. Or particularly like us.
Like I said, I think that was a strange home for it at the time, but it had a home. That was the good thing, and it became huge. But it's almost like maybe it should have been somewhere else.
Did anybody here go to San Diego Comic-Con this year? No? It was Nickelodeon did a huge 25th anniversary celebration, right? And all of the Nicktoons people were there. And represented all the shows, all the creators were there and everything, but not Ren and Stimpy.
Now, so you mentioned this to me earlier, and I couldn't get why. Do you have any insight as to why that is? I'm sure you have an idea why.
I think the adult party cartoons killed the franchise. I think they did, and no one will touch it now. It's like poison. You know.
Because there was supposed to be something, I think, we talked about this, there was supposed to be a new short that was ahead of the SpongeBob, the latest SpongeBob movie.
Yeah.
What do you know about?
I heard that they were going to let John do a short. And we're like, what? You nuts?
And this is Nickelodeon.
No, it wasn't Nickelodeon, it was Paramount. Okay. See, that's the thing, it's like, Paramount is the film arm of Viacom. So these executives at Paramount didn't really know the history or understand, you know, what was going on with Ren and Stimpy. It's like, oh, Ren and Stimpy, that was funny. Who's that guy, John? Yeah, get him in here. We'll make a cartoon. I don't think they really were hip to what was going on with that, but I understand they've since killed it, so.
Okay, so it's completely not going to happen, or is it just something that's dragging?
Look, it's San Diego. The name of the entire celebration was Happy, Happy, Joy, Joy, 25 years of Nicktoons. I made Happy, Happy, Joy, Joy up. And I couldn't get into the convention. I tried for a year to get into San Diego, and I got turned down and turned down and turned down. I couldn't get a table. I couldn't buy a table. I couldn't get in.
But no reference as to why, or nobody's giving you any kind of explanation on that?
It's... No, you know, I see all this.
Bring it back seems like a license to print money at this point.
It would. I agree. And if they said, and I have one in my head. I have a complete feature, a Ren and Stimpy feature in my head.
A feature film.
Look in my ear. You can see it.
I see little bits of it. There's some spoiler alerts. So I don't want to tell anybody,
but
it's not one of those gross ups in their ear.
It's the thing about it is those companies are so big. I think they can afford to not care. They can afford to sit on it. You know, if they don't make a Ren and Stimpy movie, yeah, sure, it'd make a lot of money, but who needs the grief? You know? But they had...
Do you think the players involved might be the issue?
Or
a player involved?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And okay. I think no one wants to deal with that. No one wants to play that game anymore. I'd be happy to do it, but, you know, at this point, I'll just do something else. You know? And I do this to keep these characters alive. I do this so that you guys can talk about your favorite shows. I can do sketches for you. You can buy prints, and we can talk about Ren and Stimpy and talk about the shows we love and the funny moments, you know, and meet with the fans. I don't have to do this, but I want to. And the idea that somebody else in the world is doing this for the show is just not true. Nobody's doing this. Me and Michelle are doing this. We're going all over talking about Ren and Stimpy, keeping the love alive, you know?
keep the spirit alive of these characters, yeah.
Yeah, because they're really terrific. And every day I have somebody tell me, what an important part of their childhood it was. And for helping them develop their sense of humor and making them who they are, I think it's a pretty good legacy. People, every day, people come up to me and thank me for Log. I go, why? It's the dumbest thing in the world. I mean, that was filler. We had like a minute to fill, so we made that up. John said, well,
that was a way to extend the cartoon.
It was. He said, do something about Log. So I went, okay. So I looked at a bunch of TV commercials from the 50s and 60s, like cartoon TV commercials.
Yeah.
And so I ripped off Slinky and Maple cereal ads, and I put together Log. But the fact that people, I love Log. It's just insane to me, that there's people even think about Log, It's I wrote the song. I wrote the Log song, right? And I was talking to somebody recently. I said, look, you know what? Screw Paul McCartney. I bet more people know the Log song than they'll hate you. Right? Do I get a dime out of it? No.
I would not disagree with it. We have a couple more minutes.
Any questions?
We're all the way in the back. Roll out.
So, In the Army is one of my favorite episodes, and I can't find it to buy it.
How do I buy In the Army? Is the question.
I don't know. I don't even own copies of my own cartoons. I had digital copies of them that burned up in a fire along with all my art books and stuff. And there are DVDs out. I did not... Here it comes, folks. I did not even get copies of the DVDs when they came out. I was not given copies. I was not asked to do the director's commentaries on my own cartoons. Someone else did that. You can guess who. And I'm really not sure. You can watch Hulu. Hulu has Ren and Stimpy's Running in a Loop. They're on Splat at night. You can watch them there. Just check eBay. And there's always those cool orange cassettes. Remember those VHS cassettes? Those still work real good, and they're probably pretty uncut. You can get those. Any other questions? Any more?
Right here?
Yeah.
Well, you did two episodes of SpongeBob recently, Lost in Bikini Bottom and Pull Up a Barrel.
Yeah.
Are you planning on working on Nickelodeon again? And if so, are you going to work on a cartoon of your very own?
I would love to. I'm not talking to Nickelodeon about anything right now. I did work on those cartoons. They were fun. But I realized that I didn't want to work on SpongeBob. It's being run by Vince Waller, who worked on Ren and Stimpy. He did Rubber Nipple Salesman, So give me an idea who's in charge of SpongeBob now. That's terrific. But I didn't want to do that thing. And so I'm focusing on my own stuff. I've got a lot of ideas I'm working on right now, a couple of graphic novel ideas, some animated stuff, and when that stuff's ready, I'll make announcements. And if you want to check out what's going on, look up Bob Lab, B-O-B-L-A-B, which is my company name. It's the name of my studio.
You got Bob Lab Studios is Facebook?
Bob Lab Studios, and it's just Bob Lab because it's fun to say Bob Lab, Bob Lab, Bob Lab.
So you're on Facebook, Twitter,
we're on Facebook, on Facebook. So look up Bob Lab Studios on Facebook. You can post stuff there. You can see what's going on.
And is it bobcampcartoonist.blogspot.com? Is that
bobcampcartoonist.blogspot.com? That's my old blog. As soon as Facebook came along, I blew off my blog. It's been great, sweetheart, but I don't need you anymore.
You left her.
But it's still there if you want to look at it. And I've got lots of drawings there and a lot of art theories and stuff like that.
Well, we're going to follow you on Facebook. We're going to follow you anywhere you go because we love what you do and we can't wait to see what's coming up. So,
cool.
How about a big round of applause? Happy 20th anniversary.
And feel free to come by the table and share your stupid cartoon stories with me. And
you were downstairs, you're doing drawings, doing commissions, you're signing stuff, you're meeting.
Yeah, and if you know the words to any of the Ren and Stimpy songs, I will sing them with you out loud in front of total strangers.
Oh, what more do you want? That's amazing. Thank you.
And my thanks to Bob Camp for a terrific Q&A at Terrificon. If you'd like to catch the video of it, just like my Q&A with Rick Hoberg, Dork Times, they were rolling video on a bunch of panels. Check out their YouTube channel for some Trificon visuals. Big thanks to those folks as well. Don't forget, episode 150 of Comic Book Central, my third anniversary special, that is right around the corner, Saturday, November 5th. It's going to be here before we know it. These weeks are flying by. As always, a cool giveaway is going to be announced. You put yourself in line for it by dropping me a line, joe@comicbookcentral.net, or you can click the Signal Me tab on the website. Tell me your favorite moment from the past year of the show, anything from episode 101 on. I'm going to play those moments on the third anniversary special. I will pick one email for the giveaway. So you're going to want to get those emails in. Cool giveaway I'm going to be announcing soon, and you're going to want to get in on that. All right, kids, Terrificon Week continues tomorrow with my Q&A with the savior of the universe, Flash Gordon himself, Sam Jones. That is tomorrow's bonus episode. Until then, think about those cool moments from Comic Book Central that you want to tell me about. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations, 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
What rolls past stairs, a boner and pears, rolls over your neighbor's dog. What's great for a snack, it fits on your back, it's log, log, log. It's log, log, it's big, it's heavy, it's wood. It's log, log, it's better than bad, it's good. Everyone wants a log, you're gonna love it long. Come on and get your log, everyone needs a log.
Log from Blammo.